Hi, Walter. Thank you for doing this webinar for us today. You can take it away.
Hello, everyone, and blessings. Welcome to Theseus and the Minotaur, an esoteric consideration and navigating the probationary spiritual path. First, some introduction. This is first in a series of Moria Federation student webinars. And if you're not already familiar with it, the Moria Federation is an esoteric spiritual school aligned with the works of theosophical authors such as Alice A. Bailey, and that will be the source of certain spiritual references that can be seen in some of the slides here. And I would like to give thanks to my fellow organizers, Joe Kay, and the Moria Federation as a whole for making this webinar possible. I personally am a graduate of the Moria Federation 5-year Quest Universal program, and now I am playing the role of assistant faculty, so that means I have a dual mixture of student and teacher. And really, we all are, to some degree, students, and we all have the potential to be teachers. And that's significant at this time to mention because the message of dualities and recognizing them and integrating them are an important aspect of the Theseus and the Minotaur myth. Anyway, there is lots to cover here, but still there should be time for questions. And you are welcome to type in questions or comments in the chat box at the bottom of the panel, the right panel. And another option is if you have a microphone, and preferably a headset to avoid static issues that can come from that, then you can also raise your hand to speak audio with audio by pressing the green up arrow raise hand button. And if that button happens to be red, then that means your hand is already raised and you can press it again to lower it. If you have connection challenges or want to view this webinar in an alternate manner, you can go to joinwebinar.com and enter the 9-digit ID pictured. And also afterwards, a recording of this whole webinar and a PDF of all these slides will be made available on http://makara.us. So a little bit about me. I have worked with labyrinths and mazes for many years, and I have a website with the URL pictured on astrolog.org. Here's a few sample pictures of work I've done with labyrinths. First is myself and my wife at Knossos on the island of Crete, which is the site of the mythical labyrinth and where the myth takes place. And next is a life-size maze I've made on the sand at a beach, which you can see part of it there. And also are some news articles of a large computer maze I made back in the mid-1980s. And then more than 30 years later, finally there's a picture of a virtual labyrinth walking app that I've done. So anyway, in summary, I love labyrinths and mazes. So about myths, and more specifically their esoteric interpretation, I wanted to start with this quotation, which is, "The only way we can find the clue to the mysteries of the rays, systems, and hierarchies lies in the study of the law of correspondences or analogy. It is the one thread by which we can find our way through the labyrinth. And that's from Initiation, Human, and Solar. So it shows the nature of looking at the inner message, but also it's notable since it refers to labyrinths and threads. And esoteric interpretation of myths is similar to, from Patanjali's Steps to Union, the step of spiritual reading. And spiritual reading doesn't mean just reading spiritual literature, but spiritual reading is really seeing meaning beyond just the physical or beyond just the outer form of things, by seeing the significance and the inner meaning of things. So in myths, the various heroes, villains, other characters, and the situations can be seen as archetypes for aspects of being or aspects of each one of ourselves. That is similar to the Bible, where Jesus taught through, very frequently, through allegory and stories. So myths are like lessons. But still, at the same time, I have to emphasize that we are much more than just a set of archetypes. We are much more than just astrological signs or rays and so on. So anyway, what will follow here is just one possible interpretation for the Theseus and the Minotaur myth, and is also only one possible set of things to focus on in this myth. And I will, in here, first look at the two aspects in a dual way. First, the objective or concrete things that took place in the myth, and then later look at the more subjective or abstract meaning of what that actually represents and what its significance is. In an earlier webinar set, Francis Donald did some sacred geometry webinars, and he did the same thing, looking at the more outer form and then the inner meaning. And then also, finally, I like to say that each character or archetype here can also be seen as a useful object of meditation. So the myths aren't just lessons or things there, but they're interactive. They can apply to each one of us. So first, let's look at Theseus, one of the main characters. So Theseus was the prince of Athens in Greece and the son of King Aegeus. And Theseus was a hero who went on a variety of adventures, not just involving the labyrinth and the Minotaur. And some of his adventures were quite noble, while others were quite foolish and reckless. So, for example, at times he was so revered for his wisdom that Athenians would say whenever any adventure was proposed, not without Theseus, and that they wouldn't want to go if Theseus didn't go. But then at other times, Theseus was actually rather foolish and not appreciated, such that at the time of his death, the Athenians didn't even bother recovering his body because it was like, woo, glad to be rid of him. So Theseus is a very dual figure, a mixed figure. But anyway, for the actual start of the Theseus and the Minotaur myth, it started in a dark time for Athens, when Athens was enthralled to the neighboring kingdom of Crete, where King Minos of Crete forced the Athenians to send as tribute 7 youths and 7 maidens each year to be taken to Crete and thrown in the labyrinth and be killed and eaten by the Minotaur monster. So Theseus, not liking the situation, volunteered to be one of the tributes sent to Crete. And on the way, since they didn't know if he would be successful or not, upon returning, or upon sailing back to Athens, it would have a white sail on the ship if Theseus was successful and had killed the Minotaur, or a black sail if Theseus had failed and had been killed by the Minotaur in return. Anyway, on Crete, Theseus fell in love with King Minos's daughter Ariadne, vice versa, and Ariadne gave Theseus a special clue of thread, which Theseus used to venture into the labyrinth and not get lost. And in the labyrinth, he fought and successfully slayed the Minotaur, and afterward, he escaped Crete with Ariadne and the other rescued Athenians. Oh, and so they couldn't be pursued by King Minos's crew. Theseus poked holes in the Minoan ships so that they couldn't chase them. So what are some of the more significance or meaning of Theseus? Well, first of all, Theseus is a classical hero. And his story here is similar to the hero's journey as described by Joseph Campbell. And it involves many of the same steps, such as hearing the call, like going to Crete in the first place, then meeting the allies along the way, such as Ariadne, and then the journey into the underworld, like going into the labyrinth, and the resurrection afterward. And it's important to realize that each one of us is Theseus. We are all the hero of our own life journey. Theseus also represents willfulness and the ability to take action, whether on a personal selfish level or on a divine level inspired by service. And so, in summary, Theseus is at a mixed level of evolution in that he shows both wisdom and recklessness at times. And again, these dual choices and this dual nature is one of the prime messages of the myth. So Theseus can be seen as an integrated personality, which means that he has a strong physical body, strong emotions, and a strong mind, and they're all integrated together that allows him to do things and manifest things, whether, again, wisely or foolishly. But he is still a strong personality. But still, he is irregular in his spirituality, and he's still in the area of purification, personal purification, and developing his character. And that is the definition of what can be called the probationary spiritual path, which means you're on probation, effectively, and are not completely in the stream, or not completely what might be considered a disciple, but it's the more that earlier irregular stage that's more personally oriented. But still, I can say that it does apply to, I would say, everyone to some degree. In a sense, we are all developing character, and we are all working on ourselves, just as on another level, we are all more advanced disciples. And there's a quote that says, "For all our disciples, from the humblest aspirant up to and beyond the Christ himself." And that's an extract by a statement from the Tibetan master. So anyway, we can all be seen as disciples. I claim that we are all probationers in a way. And if you can show me someone who claims they're not a probationer in some sense and no longer needs to develop character, then I might say that there's a chance that perhaps they do need to develop character and work on overcoming pride. So anyway, with Theseus, there's a few example personal meditation subjects, such as, am I on my own hero's journey, and how am I fulfilling it? And for the things that I'm doing in life, am I acting recklessly or am I acting wisely? And also, looking at my environment, what problems or oppression, whether within myself, applying just to myself, or even to the world around me, am I aware of? So is there something that it's time for me to step up and volunteer for? So now let's look at the Minotaur. The Minotaur is a half-man, half-bull monster, and it had a body of a man and the head of a bull. The Minotaur was the son of King Minos' wife, Queen Pasiphae, and a special sacred bull called the Cretan Bull. And it came about where King Minos refused to sacrifice the Cretan bull to the gods, which offended the gods, and as a result, they made King Minos' wife, Pasiphae, desire the Cretan bull, and as a result, she gave birth to the Minotaur. Now, of course, they didn't really like that, and so the Minotaur was hidden in the labyrinth in shame and hidden away, until the Minotaur was eventually faced by and slain by Theseus. So the more meaning or significance of the Minotaur is looking at a creature looking at a man with an animal head, like the bull's head means a person guided by animalistic desires. That has a name esoterically, kama manas, which is like desire mind. It's like a not just the instinctual nature of animals, but it's the animal nature intertwined with the human nature of intellect, which can actually be very harmful. Like consider the problem of, say, a lion that can hunt humans but does so instinctually versus, say, like a psychopathic killer that has the human faculties but it's mixed in a very degraded fashion. So the Minotaur is a monster that really represents the extreme negative potentials when humanity goes downward into the animalistic drives. And therefore, Theseus slaying the Minotaur is an allegory for slaying the evil nature within ourselves. And each one of us has a shadow self or a Minotaur within ourselves to a greater or lesser degree. The whole Minotaur and the Minotaur myth to some degree can be seen as like a Greek version of Saint George slaying the dragon, where the dragon is like another negative manifestation that gets slain by us as we grow. Now, of course, I like dragons, and dragons I think can be also very spiritual, but it's just important to recognize the meaning that in this case a dragon is representing negativity. And then slaying it isn't really about murder or violence or killing, but slaying the dragon is more about overcoming these negative natures. Another thing about the bull and about the Minotaur being related to with a bull's head and the Cretan bull represents older energies on the human evolutionary path. In other words, this was at a time of this myth when the age of Taurus was ending, the astrological age of Taurus, and the new Age of Aries was the newest energies at the time. And so slaying the Minotaur is also a way of representing moving beyond the old worshiping the bull, so to speak, and moving into the more modern eras and energies. So anyway, the Minotaur can also be a useful subject of meditation. For example, we can ask ourselves and meditate on, like, what desires am I compelled by? Not just what do I aspire to, but what really unconsciously compels me, if anything. And also, we can ask, like, what negative structures have I created in my own life, or what has society created? And then also, what have I or society hidden away and tried to hide in shame instead of actually bringing to the surface and resolving? So let's see, I'm just seeing if there's any questions. There aren't at this time, so we will move on. So now let's look at the labyrinth in which the myth takes place. And first, there's a few things to say about some definitions about mazes and labyrinths. And there are two different words, but maze and labyrinth are traditionally synonymous in the dictionary. More specifically, the word maze is an old English word, and it means to confuse or confound. And similarly, labyrinth is a Greek word that is similar to the word labrys, that represents a double-headed axe. And the double-headed axe symbol is very commonly seen in Cretan art and culture. Now, in modern usage, a maze is a multi-path intellectual puzzle with choices that you can get lost in, such as seen in the upper left, while a labyrinth is a single unicursal path that there's no choices, so you just walk straight through its twists and turns. And the labyrinth is very commonly walked today as a physical, spiritual meditation. So that means that the labyrinth from mythology that Theseus and the Minotaur were in is actually a maze puzzle and is an exception to the more modern usage. And there are always exceptions to rules, and there are a few other exceptions to this. Like, for example, in the very excellent movie from 1986 starring David Bowie, the movie Labyrinth, that featured a giant maze. And also in the other direction, there are in things in England called mizmazes, which are technically unicursal turf labyrinths. So yes, you can say maze is a puzzle and a labyrinth is a single path, but that doesn't always apply. And then there's a nice quote that summarizes the difference, which is, you can lose yourself in a maze, you can find yourself in a labyrinth. So the labyrinth in the Theseus and the Minotaur myth. It started where King Minos had Daedalus the craftsman build the labyrinth to house the Minotaur and hide it away. And the labyrinth is a very challenging and tough to solve maze puzzle, where even Daedalus himself, it said, once he built it, he could barely find his own way out of it. And again, the labyrinth was used where the Crete forced Athens to send their 7 youths and maidens to be taken to Crete annually and thrown in the labyrinth to be fed to the Minotaur. And when Theseus entered the labyrinth himself, he had some extra help. He used Ariadne's clue of thread to find his way to the center without being lost, and then to exit the labyrinth. And there's another part of the role that the labyrinth plays, is that after Theseus and Ariadne left, Daedalus and his son Icarus were imprisoned in the labyrinth by King Minos, who was understandably annoyed at the role that Daedalus played by helping Ariadne by giving her the clue of thread. And before Daedalus and Icarus escaped the labyrinth themselves by building the famous pairs of wax wings and flying out. So, the more esoteric meaning of the labyrinth. First, the labyrinth basically represents life. Like, life is a labyrinth. And more specifically, the labyrinth is like our earthly environment, or physical maya. And maya means the, like, the physical glamour that we're all subjected to in, like, being spiritual beings having a physical experience, that we are often disconnected from spirituality while physically incarnated. We have the things like fear of death and all the physical passions that frequently drive us. And all those things are represented and summarized by the labyrinth. And like a maze, life features blindness. In other words, you can't see your way through a maze. You kind of stumble through it and have to try things. And similarly, life is the same way. Like, we can't see the way. And a maze takes effort to navigate, just as just as life takes effort, so does a maze. And also there is risk, so to speak, in a maze, as there is in life. I mean, we just don't know what's going to happen. I mean, for all I know, a meteor is going to land on me and kill me before I finish the sentence. And similarly, in a maze, we navigate through the maze of life, and who knows, you may reach the center, or it may be a dead end, or there may be a minotaur around the corner. We just don't know. And a maze is also very interesting. It's a balance of fate and free will. In other words, it's a big question, is the universe fated, or do we have free will? And I'd say that the answer is a little bit of both. And a maze is an excellent symbol of the process of life and the mixture of fate and free will. In other words, there are twists and turns that in a maze that we are forced to take, and that represents circumstance or karma. And however, we also have choices, and there is the junctions where it's up to us the choices that we take at the times we're able to make them. So a maze really can teach us that it's not the hand you're dealt, to use an analogy of playing cards, but it's how you play that hand that matters. So the Cretan labyrinth that has a monster in the center of the labyrinth is basically a corruption, or a negative, dense corruption of the more spiritual view that has illumination, spiritual illumination in the center of the labyrinth. Like, modern usage of labyrinth walking has us walk to the center of a labyrinth and then at the center, you release while walking in, and then in the center, you receive illumination on whatever is being meditated on. And that's a very positive approach. Where here, you can see it's a very negative inversion of that, where you have people fearfully thrown in the labyrinth to run around in fear, and then at the center, there's a monster that eats you. I mean, there's sort of the death and transformation energy that's applying either way, but still one is very dense and negative while the other is much more positive. Oh, and there's even things in between. Like in European culture, traditionally certain maidens would respond to suitors by standing in the middle of life-size stone labyrinths, and then her suitor would race to the center, pick her up, and then carry her out, and see if he could carry her out. And so it shows that labyrinths can really represent many things in life. They can represent bloody death, or romantic love, or spiritual illumination. So the seven youths and seven maidens that were going into the labyrinth to die can be seen on a more esoteric level as like the nature of the physical and spiritual and more subtle planes, like the physical and astral matter, and how our bodies continually die through the process of incarnation. So you can see those seven youths and seven maidens annually dying as like the subplanes of matter forming our physical and more subtle bodies, how they continually die. And which of course means that overcoming the Minotaur is in a way overcoming death or fear of death, or the quest more toward spiritual enlightenment. So the labyrinth also has a number of meditation subjects, which is like, where am I, or where are we as a collective group, where are we in the labyrinth of life? And what is my relation with the environment around me? Am I struggling with it, resisting it, am I working with it? And then finally, what limitations and choices in life am I being presented with at this time? So another thing about mazes, and another more spiritual aspect about them, is that mazes have a tree structure. In other words, there's passages and then passages that branch off the passages and then like leaf-like dead ends. And so there are other things in our own bodies and beings that also have a tree structure like a maze, such as our bloodstream has a tree structure similar to a maze, as does our nervous system, and as does the network of breathing tubes in our lungs. So in other words, our body is like a maze. And more spiritually, these things like the tree of knowledge representing the nervous system, or the tree of life, can also be seen as inner mazes. And on a more etheric level, there's the etheric nervous system. And a maze can even be seen as representing those etheric nervous systems. Where in the etheric nervous system, you have two sides. There's the cool feminine Ida part and the more fiery masculine Pingala on the two sides, and then going up between them is the Sushumna, which is seen pictured here. And that's very similar to a maze, where you can see you have the two halves of a maze, and then there's the solution path going down them. So we are in the maze of life, but we also have the maze of life within us. So beyond Theseus and the Minotaur, the character of Ariadne is significant and is also worthy of looking at. So Ariadne is the daughter of King Minos and Queen Pasiphae. That means the Minotaur is actually her half-brother. And she fell in love with Theseus upon seeing him, being one of the Athenians volunteering, and vice versa. They fell in love with each other. And as a result, she helped him by giving him the clue of thread, which is a ball of string, so that, or an enchanted ball of string, really, so that he could find his way through the labyrinth. And beyond Ariadne's clue of thread, she also gave him a sword so that he could fight the Minotaur, because of course King Minos didn't really give the Athenians weapons when they were thrown in. But Theseus had a sword, and he had the clue of thread. And then after the Minotaur was slain, Ariadne left Crete with Theseus. And there's more adventures that happened after they left, but those will be gotten to later. So the more significance or meaning of Ariadne is that Ariadne is really the soul presence.
Walter.
And, yes.
Sorry, this is BL. You have a question from Karen. She says, why was the ball magical?
Oh, yes. And that is saying that there's more to the, like, in some parts of the myth, the clue of thread, you could unroll it and it would unroll itself, and it would unroll itself back up. So that is very enchanted. We'll see once you get a little bit about toward Daedalus more about it. But yes, it doesn't have to be like that, but definitely the more significance of the clue of thread is we'll see that it really does represent a strong spiritual aspect. So it's more than just a ball of yarn, even though it is taking the form of a ball of yarn in the myth. So anyway, yes, Ariadne is...
She says, thank you, brilliant.
Oh, you're welcome. So, yes, so Ariadne is representing really the soul influence, or the love aspect, that exists within us all. And so on a more meaningful level, Theseus and Ariadne can be seen as one being, because both of them exist within us. And if you're wondering why did Ariadne fall in love with Theseus, I mean, it wasn't just because he was handsome or anything like that, but really it's more when Theseus was acting unselfishly and he was acting in service to Athens by going to Crete and volunteering. And so it's important to realize that when you act in service and are no longer thinking of yourself as an individual and are thinking of the group, that brings in the soul energies. So it's like Theseus becoming more spiritual, and as a result, Ariadne comes. It's kind of similar to when the student is ready, the master appears. And of course, the Ariadne's clue of thread is extremely significant. And just as the labyrinth is the physical environment or Maya that we're all immersed in, the spiritual clue of thread can guide us through it. And even more deeply, the clue of thread can be seen as the antakarana, or the consciousness thread that connects our personalities and our daily consciousness to, if the thread is present and built, to our soul, and even beyond that, to our divine spirit. And so really the examples of threads and their role in spiritual growth, it really appears in a number of important, significant places. Like there's a stage of spiritual discipleship called the chela on the thread, which indicates one is connected to deeper energies, and not just as an isolated individual. And also in the Alice Bailey material, there is meditation about where groups can approach the master and the ashram along a golden thread. There's like a visualization of picturing yourself on a golden thread and following that golden thread, or letting the golden thread draw you into toward the master and toward greater unity. So Ariadne is not just the spiritual thread, but she also gave Theseus a sword. And the sword is not just a violent weapon, but on the spiritual meaning aspect, the sword represents the mind and the mind's ability to discriminate and discern accurately. And so another aspect of spirituality that when it comes in is it does allows us to see clearly. And that is the nature of the sword. And of course, seeing clearly is the real weapon against the minotaur. It's not like physical violence stabbing a monster, but what's really going on here is Theseus is using the spiritual connection as represented by the clue of thread, and his clear seeing and clear thinking represented by the sword, to overcome the negative potentials within. And then he slays the minotaur within, so to speak, and then can be in a relatively glamour-freed, more spiritual existence. Now, Ariadne is a very interesting character, and she actually exists outside of the myth, and even existed before Greek culture came in and created the myth that we're seeing now. So there's much more to her than I'm just saying here. Like, there's ancient art pieces that depict her as a priestess holding up two snakes. And snakes can represent wisdom and initiation, similar to in Egyptian mysticism, like the pharaoh headdresses that have this snake rising that can represent anything from kundalini having risen to you know, advanced levels of wisdom. So Ariadne has a few meditations that can be useful to contemplate. Like primarily is, am I aware of my soul? And am I aware of my own thread that connects me to the higher aspects of myself? Like in other words, without the soul, we're just in our body, emotions, and minds. We're like trapped in our body and its urges, or in our emotions and the passions that drive us, or our continually chattering mind. But we're much more than that. Behind our body, emotions, and thoughts is the consciousness and our intuition. And we're not always aware of that, but the Ariadne's thread, we can hold on to it and follow it. And so we can also say, if I am aware of spirituality and am aware of that around me, am I following the thread? Because a thread or a antakarana highway is not useful if we're not actually using it. And then also for the mental sword is, am I using my mind correctly? The I mean, a sword is a useful analogy for the mind because it is a tool. It can be used to help, but we can also hurt ourselves or others with it if we misuse it. So Ariadne's thread appears in a number of places in the Alice Bailey references, and here are a few quotes from four different books, and here I'll read a couple of them. The thread which will guide us out of the bewildering maze of thought into which we must perforce enter is the golden one of group love, group understanding, group relations, and group conduct. And that's from Esoteric Psychology, Volume 2. And then another quote, through this illusory panorama, the aspirant has to make his way, finding the clue or thread which will lead him out of the maze, and holding fast to each tiny fragment of reality as it presents itself to him, learning to distinguish truth from glamour, the permanent from the impermanent, and the certainty from the unreal. So this shows that the maze of life, or the maze of illusion, and also the golden thread that leads us through it are very significant, and as we can see, they appear in quite a few different references. So let's look at King Minos and see more about what King Minos is and represents. But first, some objective things about what he is and did. King Minos, again, was the ruler of Crete, and the myth basically started when he refused to sacrifice this sacred white bull to the gods, and he liked it so much that he held on to the bull and refused to sacrifice it out of his own greed and pride. And as a result, the gods were offended and cursed his wife, Queen Pasiphae, to desire the bull, and as a result, give birth to the Minotaur. Now, King Minos's son, Androgeus, was very talented, and at the Olympic Games in Athens, he won all the prizes. And as a result, the Athenians were jealous of him and killed him. And that is what caused King Minos to wrathfully basically conquer Athens and force them to submit seven youths and seven maidens each year to be eaten by the Minotaur. King Minos, as we know, is also the father of Ariadne. And eventually, which we'll get to, he will be killed by Daedalus the craftsman, who built the labyrinth. And then after his death, King Minos became one of three judges of the underworld, working for Hades, the god of death. So let's see some of the more inner meaning or significance of King Minos. In a word, King Minos represents density, or the dominance of matter that imprisons the spirit, and physical circumstance, and also somewhat selfishness. And those things, density combined with selfishness, is what spiritually is called the left-hand path. And also, that would make King Minos what would also be called a black magician. Not as like a malicious devil type figure, but just someone who is using their energy more selfishly and densely as opposed to more altruistically and spiritually. And also King Minos is associated with karma, and which again is why he became a judge of the underworld, helping out Hades. And karma plays a role because the Athenians were entirely blameless for what happened. In other words, King Minos is not entirely a villain because his son was killed by the Athenians. I mean, that does not excuse his behavior, but it shows the tendency of humans to sometimes overreact or act wrathfully. And so King Minos is associated with karma, whether deserved or not, like consequences. And he's like is associated with like old style wrathful revenge, which is very Mars, associated with the planet Mars or Martian in nature. And also like an old style lord of dense matter, which can be associated with negative aspects of Saturn. Like esoterically, it's stated that sometimes the most negative people in this world were like the masters of a previous world or even a previous solar system, because long ago humanity was just developing the physicality or developing the mental aspect. And only more recently has it become like divine will for humanity to develop like love. And so sometimes the people we see as negative aren't really evil as much as they're just holding on to the old energies. They just haven't gotten with the program yet. But anyway, King Minos' refusal to sacrifice the Cretan bull can represent a attachment to what the bull represents, which is like the old Age of Taurus energies. So King Minos is kind of that, I don't want to change, representing that. Oh, and another point is that just as Theseus and Ariadne can esoterically be seen as one, so are King Minos and Pasiphae one too. Like, it may seem rather cruel or like why was Pasiphae made to fall in love with the bull? I mean, it wasn't her fault. What did she do? But when looking at more the significance, King Minos is representing the more wrathful response, and Pasiphae is more the instinctual negative response or like physical passions. So Pasiphae is kind of like a anti-Ariadne, so to speak, a negative Ariadne, like the more dense part, while Ariadne is the spiritual aspect of being. And so, yes, that does mean that we all have a Minos and Pasiphae within us, potentially, too. And another question that one might have is, like, why does such a beautiful and kind-hearted person like Ariadne have such a, well, a chauvinist pig for a father? And really, you can see it as that experience with matter, like King Minos, results in soul development, as represented by Ariadne. So it kind of makes sense that you know, through the process of physical incarnation and all the experiences and challenges that we have over many lifetimes, these experiences in matter develop soul qualities over time. And so it makes sense, esoterically, that Ariadne, the soul, would be the daughter of King Minos, who is so representing matter. So King Minos has some meditation subjects, such as, how am I using matter? Like, does it use me, or do I use it? And do I use it selfishly or altruistically? Because matter is a tool, like Theseus a sword. And also, we can consider, how am I imposing on others? Like, am I forcing my will on others in a negative sense? And another contemplation subject for King Minos is, am I behaving proportionally? In other words, King Minos having his son murdered was a negative event, but he responded and overcompensated for that by taking 14 Athenians every year for that. So we have to recognize using and acting proportionally and in the right levels and to the right degrees. So Theseus was not just a individual, but he was contemporary with a number of other Greek heroes. And primarily among them is Hercules. And Theseus and Hercules interacted together in some interesting ways. Like, for example, they were both members of the Argonauts with Jason, which was a group of a number of Greek heroes that went in search of the Golden Fleece. And so that's an example of a group quest or group activity, as opposed to Theseus, that he did the adventure in the labyrinth mostly individually. Now, Hercules actually saved Theseus, or saved his life effectively from the underworld during Hercules' 10th labor associated with Capricorn, where Hercules went to the underworld to capture Hades' three-headed dog guardian. And this is an example of Theseus' recklessness. Theseus decided that he was going to go into the underworld and rescue Persephone from Hades, because Hades had kidnapped the goddess Persephone and taken her to the underworld, which is why we have winter, or more esoterically, which is why we have continual death. So Theseus going to the underworld trying to rescue her from the gods was a little bit presumptuous, and also is him trying to effectively eliminate death. But death has a purpose, and Theseus, for his presumptuousness, was trapped in the underworld and trapped on a seat that he couldn't stand up from. And so he stayed there until Hercules, on the way, was able to free Theseus in addition to performing his own labor. And there's another one of Hercules' labors that's very related to Theseus, which is his second labor associated with the zodiac sign Taurus, which is the capture of the Cretan bull. So that white bull that King Minos refused to sacrifice, it became wild and was running around Crete randomly, and one of Hercules' labors was to capture that Cretan bull, which Hercules was able to do by basically grabbing the bull by the horns, and then Hercules rode the bull across the water back to Athens. Now, it happens that in a later adventure of Theseus, after the labyrinth, Theseus actually killed the Cretan bull and slayed it. And this shows a little bit of a distinction, because if the bull, not the half-man, half-bull, but the 100% natural bull animal, represents the animal instinctual nature, it shows that Hercules was able to tame the bull and ride it, which shows the instincts tamed and used in service. Well, Theseus was a little bit more vicious and reckless and stabbed and killed the bull. So, of course, taming is better. It's similar to how spiritually, sometimes earlier on the path, like on the probationary stage where Theseus is, you are like trying to starve out desire or starve out the passions or push things away and hide them, as opposed to actually truly tame them. And another example is how you can hear about things like, oh, here's a famous yogi who never needs to eat or never has sex or anything like that. And so then sometimes younger aspirants, they see that and they try to use the physical harshness and say, oh, I'm going to starve myself and I'm going to make myself spiritual by manipulating the physical circumstances, as opposed to realizing that physical circumstances reflect the spiritual evolution. I mean, those things tend to more come as a result of spiritual evolution. And although discipline and purification is extremely important on the path, you don't want to go overboard and have like what I would call a harshness to asceticism as sometimes people have. So anyway, all this shows that we can really see in the process of spiritual growth here that Hercules is basically acting as a senior disciple, slightly more advanced on the path, while Theseus is the junior disciple. But of course, people of all levels can work together, just as how they were both, in spite of their different levels of evolution, they were both working in the Argonauts. Anyway, I want to say that BL did an excellent series of webinars about the esoteric meaning of all 12 of the labors of Hercules that is available online. So, also we want to look at the character of Daedalus, which is very interesting. And in the myth, he was a gifted craftsman and inventor. He, for example, he introduced carpentry and masts and sails for ships to Greece. And he made statues so real, it said, that they looked alive and could even move around. So he's, you know, one step short of being able to create life. And that explains why the clue of thread could, in some versions of the myth, unroll itself up. So Daedalus built the labyrinth for King Minos to house the Minotaur. He also built a mechanical cow for Queen Pasiphae to climb inside, which is how the Minotaur was able to be conceived. And then finally, he crafted for Ariadne the clue of thread and sword, which she was then able to pass on to Theseus. So anyway, after Theseus killed the Minotaur, King Minos was understandably annoyed at Daedalus and for basically allowing for giving Ariadne the spiritual tools and that allowed the Minotaur to be killed. So King Minos responded by throwing Daedalus and his son Icarus into the labyrinth. But of course, putting someone in their own labyrinth often doesn't work very well because Daedalus crafted special wax wings for himself and his son Icarus, which allowed them to fly up and out of the labyrinth. But unfortunately, his son Icarus, while they were flying out, flew too close to the sun, which melted the wax, and so he fell into the sea. And that is how the Icarian Sea got its name. But King Minos, being wrathful, wasn't going to let it in there, so he chased Daedalus to a neighboring kingdom. And then finally, Daedalus, with the help of three daughters of a neighboring king, finally killed King Minos by pouring boiling water in King Minos's bath. So the meaning of Daedalus. Daedalus is basically representing the creative abstract mind, which esoterically is associated with Ray 3 of active creative intelligence. And Daedalus is able to effectively channel or perceive ideas and bring them down and present them to civilization, which again, there's an esoteric concept called presented attributes, which comes from the Ray 3 technique of soul fusion, which is being able to perceive what things are coming or need to come and being able to bring them forth and manifest them. So Daedalus is a deep and spiritual figure in many respects because he's behind the scenes and creates the environment in which much of the myth takes place as a whole. So Daedalus created the clue of thread for Ariadne. And so if Ariadne uses the clue of thread, then if Daedalus created the Clua thread to begin with, and that's meaning like creating the Antichrona to begin with, that you can put Daedalus on a even more higher and spiritual level, even above the soul. And so that can make him associated with triadal or even monadic energies in the highest sense. So that means we can really have like a hierarchy or sequence of levels of spiritual evolution, where there's Theseus, the personality on the probationary path, and then there's Hercules, more advanced on the path of discipleship, and there's Ariadne representing the soul and soul love, and then there's Daedalus that can be kind of seen as like an initiate working for the gods themselves, and gods being the Greek gods representing the divine energies themselves. So Daedalus flying out of the labyrinth can be seen as no longer being trapped by matter. With the labyrinth representing life, that means being able to fly up and out of it represents matter no longer having hold over you. And that's like, and so here Daedalus flew over the seas, to use a brief phrase from Rule 3 for applicants, and he did that basically literally, where the seas represent like the astral emotions that sometimes we can be entangled in or drowned within. But being able to fly over matter and the water represents a significant state of evolution.
Walter?
Yes.
You have a hand up. Thea has her hand up.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. Let me attendees. Thea, yes. Go ahead, Thea.
I don't know.
You don't know?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
This is funny. No, this was just a mistake. I don't know how it all works.
Oh, no problem.
Sorry.
No problem. Okay, so just as Daedalus basically can be seen as having a master-disciple relationship or a teacher-student relationship with his son Icarus. And it shows that even if you are able to fly over the seas and out of the labyrinth, that doesn't mean that you're free of pride or potential other problems, because his son Icarus, his son flew too close to the sun, and because Daedalus warned him not to fly too high, but Icarus was very enraptured with the concept of flying. It's like, yay, physical things no longer apply to me. And that became a slight entanglement and flew too close to the sun, and shows that there are problems of pride and potentially evolving too fast. So you can fly out, but still keep grounded. And Daedalus finally overcame King Minos, which is again representing density of matter, with the boiling bath, which is basically a mixture of fire and water. And the elements of fire and water are both associated with purification. So we can really see Daedalus slaying King Minos is again not like a violent murder, but is more of like the creative mind overcoming the density of matter through via purification. So a few meditation subjects associated with Daedalus is we can contemplate like, what have I built in life, or what have I built in my own inner being? And also, what am I in the process of building? And where am I heading in the future? And also, like, what am I presenting to the world? I mean, is it good? Is it bad? I mean, hopefully it's good.
And then Vera has her hand up. Has her hand up. Walter, I'll unmute her. Go ahead, Vera.
Okay, yeah.
Wonderful. My musing on the Icarus is this, that, okay, if Daedalus is the mind, then Icarus, using that mind, actually mind needs to be dissolved as well before actually it's too, if it just couldn't stand the heat of the sun. So my reading on it is that even the mind needs to go if we want to go higher. Because and Daedalus knew that. He knew that he cannot fly too high.
No, that. Thank you very much. That is a good interpretation, and that's a more positive aspect and potential of the myth. And yes, I do like that, because it can show that, again, Icarus falling in, flying too high, and then falling in down to the sea doesn't have to represent a physical death, but it can represent the mind or the lower mind being transcended. And so, yes, thank you. That is a very good, a potential positive interpretation. Because, yes, many of the aspects of this myth, as we'll see shortly, there are some, multiple interpretations. And, again, the dual nature of the labyrinth is that, depending on where we are, one or the other, or maybe both, to some degree, can apply. Oh, and there's another quote about here related to the labyrinth and being trapped within it. I mean, sometimes, and some of us, especially those associated with the creative imagination, can sometimes be, we may feel trapped within the labyrinth of life or trapped within a labyrinth of our own making. And that is, here's a quote, "Pulling the threads of life, I stand, enmeshed within my self-created glamour. Surrounded am I by the fabric I have woven. I see not else. The love of truth must dominate, not love of my own thoughts, or love of my ideas or forms. Love of the ordered process must control, not love of my own wild activity." And that's from the Ray 3 Technique of Integration from Esoteric Psychology 2. I mean, actually, that message is somewhat similar to Theseus in that not just acting, but acting with soul inspiration. So, what happened afterward, after Theseus and slayed the Minotaur and left with Ariadne? One interesting thing is that the Theseus and the Minotaur is very interesting because it has many different endings. And in a sense, there's no myth that really has as many different endings as Theseus and the Minotaur, which again emphasizes the nature of choices and like the maze of life. And so one ending is that Theseus and Ariadne together, representing the personality fused with the soul, they go back to Athens and live happily ever after. And that represents that the probationer, or the one who is spiritually irregular in his approach to spirituality, sometimes spiritual, sometimes selfish, is effectively becoming the disciple, or one who's in the stream and is on a more permanent, deeper, permanent level of spirituality. However, many versions of the myth have it that while traveling back to Athens, Theseus abandoned Ariadne while she was asleep on the way to Athens. So they stopped at the island of Naxos on the way to celebrate, and then Theseus went away and left her there. And this can represent, similar to Icarus in some way, or at least the potential negative approach to it, which on a whole represents that the probationer fails to remain soul-infused. In other words, Theseus abandoning Ariadne represents the risk that all of us have in our spiritual path, that just because the soul is with us doesn't necessarily mean that the soul will stay with us. It's up to us to keep that thread or that connection alive. And so after Theseus left Ariadne, again, there's a few, again, depending on the version of the myth, various things that Ariadne did or that happened. One is that they say Ariadne hanged herself out of grief. And again, that represents not the death of the soul or anything like that, but rather the soul effectively dying as far as its presence in physical life goes. And an alternate version, somewhat similar, is that Ariadne, left on the island of Naxos, was noticed by Dionysus, the god of wine, and married him. And that represents the soul directing its attention away from the physicalness, which is no longer a suitable place for the soul, and redirecting it more toward the divine. Now, just as it was said that Icarus rising to the sun can actually have a positive interpretation, there is also a positive interpretation even of Theseus leaving Ariadne on Naxos. And that was more that Theseus was told by Dionysus that he should leave her on the island. And this was more of an intentional thing that all three of them agreed on, more like the personality, soul, and spirit is intentionally doing for a positive reason. And this is more that saying that Theseus is enjoying his time with Ariadne, but that he needs to return to a life of service in Athens and go back to Athens and be king, and not be what is sometimes happens when we first encounter spiritual soul energies and be like enraptured by them. And be, because it can sometimes distract us from our effectiveness and service in the physical. And so there's the Capricorn spiritual mantra of lost am I in light supernal, yet on that light I turn my back, which represents being able to reach up and connect with the spiritual energies, but also being able to not just stay in them and not just withdraw from the world, but rather to turn back and still with the inspiration, the spiritual inspiration, to go to the world and be grounded and serve in practical ways. So in that case, Theseus wasn't really leaving Ariadne, even though he's leaving her physically, he's remembering what she taught him, so to speak, and then is going back to Athens to serve effectively there. And there's another thing that happened afterward is once Theseus returned to Athens. Now, remember when Theseus left and he had a ship and that ship was supposed to have a black sail or a white sail based on whether Theseus lived or died? Well, Theseus forgot to replace the black sail with a white sail. And as a result, he came sailing into Athens on a ship with a nice big black sail there. And then his father, King Aegeus, went, oh no, Theseus has failed. And then King Aegeus commits suicide and threw himself from a cliff into the sea, which, by the way, is how the Aegean Sea got its name. Seems like there's lots of bodies of water named after people that fell in them. And anyway, so, and then of course afterwards, Theseus became the king of Athens. So the meaning of this was, you can say there's potential a couple of reasons for that. One is that either Theseus would have grief for Ariadne, again, depending on the aversion for the myth. It's like, oh no, I no longer have Ariadne, I miss her. And then he was so preoccupied and then plain forgot. And that shows that, again, spirituality can sometimes unground us. It can make us so connected or so self-absorbed in our own spiritual path that we forget those around us. and we forget that our actions have effects on others. So Theseus foolishly can be self-absorbed in one way or another, and then forgets to do something simple like let his father know that he's alive. And so again, that's as a result, there's two possible messages. One is a more negative one, or rather a more challenging issue that warns us to the spiritual preoccupation with like the you know experiences of spiritual enlightenment or the radiant experiences that we may have, that they can interfere with physical effectiveness. However, there is also a positive meaning to this, which is more esoterically, it represents the whole concept of Theseus replacing his father as king of Athens is representing the replacing of the old with the new. In other words, Theseus's father, King Aegeus, was part of the old guard. He was either like willing to submit to Crete and or at least wasn't taking action to do anything about it. He was more static and stagnant. And Theseus is representing the newer energies of being able to take action in order to make the world a better place. And so King Aegeus dying is, again, not necessarily a negative thing that's physical, someone physically dying, but is representing the death of the old energies. And Theseus coming in and becoming king is a new energies and being willing to take action, and of course him having the opportunity to, again in the dual nature of this myth, having the opportunity to be wise or foolish and hopefully more of the former and less of the latter as he goes on his own hero's journey. So that has reached the end of the set of slides that are here to share today. And so this is a good opportunity for more questions if anybody has them.
I'd like to thank you, Walter. This was a really wonderful presentation. And I would wonder now if we might want to, while we're waiting for people to formulate questions or comments, introduce both B.L. Allison and Eva Smith, who are on the webinar as staff with us today. B.L., you might want to, since you did the whole series on Hercules, let people know about the opportunities, if they're not already currently part of Moria Federation, the two meditation programs. Might be worth mentioning those right now, and then we do have a question. I see that Tiffany has her hand up. Yael, do you have anything to add?
Well, I want to thank Walter for putting the website in there where the Hercules, the labors of Hercules, there's actually 13 because there's an introduction and then the 12 labors. So thank you very much for doing that, Walter. And also, this was a great augmentation to that program. At that same website, www.makara.us, we have all of our student webinars. And some of them were private as far as attending goes. You must be a student. But others were actually open. But all of them are open to the public to view. So they're all available there at that same website, and Eva and I both did a significant number of webinars. So.
Thank you so much, BL. I'm going to unmute Tiffany. Thank you, Tiffany, for having a question. Go ahead.
Hi. My question, I wrote it, is there anything in the story that kind of represents the mind of the disciple, the subconscious mind of the disciple?
Yes. I would say that the that Ariadne and Pasiphae both represent the different aspects of the subconscious mind. I mean, Pasiphae is more the instinctual, more animal-related types of the subconscious, and then especially the subconscious mind of the disciple, that's more the intuition, and that's definitely more represented by Ariadne and the influences that can come down her clue of thread.
Walter, Eva here.
Yes.
I wanted to really thank you and tell you how much I appreciate the esoteric interpretation of what you offered. I know for myself, over the years, I've read a lot of the myths, the Greek myths, and without that extra piece of understanding the esoteric aspects of it, it just becomes a story. You brought it to life in such a wonderful way. I have to tell you that it really spoke to me, and I really saw how this works with all the material that we have learned from the Ageless Wisdom. So thank you very much in appreciation.
Oh, you are very welcome, and thanks again for your making this webinar possible.
We have a comment from Karen. Thank you for your presentation. It's brilliant. It greatly deepened my understanding of the myth. Thank you for all the esoteric and spiritual wisdom entwined in it. I love working with the labyrinth, and this is absolutely wonderfully enhancing my work with it. So thank you. And for those of you who are on your phones or not on your phones, I'd like to mention I have my phone going, and if you're on the webinar there, we have 16 likes that have come through during the course of the webinar, little hearts that people have sent your way, Walter. So people are very pleased.
Well, hearts and love in return. And definitely, as the final slide says, thank you all for coming and being here, and have an amazing day.
Great, Walter. Thank you. And Eva and BL, thank you also. We will have the recording and the slides up on Makara as soon as possible, for sure this week. And make sure you check the Ask broadcast and webinar schedule. There's lots coming as we approach Thanksgiving and the entry into Sagittarius. We're going to stop the webinar, close it now. Thank you all. Have a wonderful holiday season. And please encourage those who are not part of our student process with Moria Federation to join Meditation Quest or to join the Great Quest. Bye-bye, all.